From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Che Guevara was a superstar of romantic and real rebellion in the 1960s. Born Ernesto Guevara to a well-off Argentine family in 1928, the man who became globally known as Che was a key ally of Fidel Castro in Cuba's revolution. He traveled Latin America and beyond with a message of revolutionary anti-imperialism. 37 years ago this week, he was captured and executed on orders of the CIA in Bolivia. And now he's back. In the movies, with the Motorcycle Diaries, in the popular culture and imagination, and interestingly, back at a time when the word imperialism is in vogue again. But what does Che mean this time? Tonight on Point, the surprising return of Che Guevara. Jim Hoberman is film critic for The Village Voice. He wrote an article headlined Ernesto Goes to the Movies for the October issue of The American Prospect. I asked him what he makes of this latest cinematic portrayal of Che Guevara.
Well, I think that Motorcycle Diaries is a departure in that it focuses on the pre-revolutionary Che, young man Che, Che the hipster and the poet, different than the Che who was martyred in Bolivia.
You have followed Che Guevara's image and public pop culture understanding of him over the years, his sort of ups and downs of popularity. He seems to be really resurgent now. What do you make of that resurgence?
One of the reasons is because he's become what semioticians might call an empty signifier. In other words, what Che meant in 1968 is not what he means today. In fact, a lot of the passions have died down, and although there's a whole political aspect to Che Guevara, at this point, he's like a trademark of the 60s. You know, he's well known for being well known. He didn't need Andy Warhol to have his image flashed all over the world. This, I think, is what contributes to his current status.
Of course, there's the famous portrait by Alberto Korda, Che, with the beret and his hair blowing tangled in the wind. But there are many images that people could draw up from the past. Even from the 60s, there are many. Why Che? Why now?
Well, he was always a romantic figure. In fact, he was probably the most romantic figure that international communism ever produced. And also, you know, was seen as kind of chivalrous, too, almost quixotic in his quest for revolution. That's very attractive. And the fact that he died or was martyred at such a young age means that he's forever young. You know, he was a kind of icon of third world, youth culture, Marxist-Leninism, all those things. And those are powerful constituencies in a way. And even if he's embraced for other reasons, he still has this kind of credibility of having been almost a movie star who operated in history.
And give us a sense of all the ways in which his image, the idea, the image of Che have played out, have been used over the years.
To a certain degree, it depends on where you are. Of course, he has a very powerful meaning still in Cuba. He was emblematic of the revolution and then also of the new socialist man, the ideal figure that would be produced in a revolutionary society. In Bolivia, where he was killed, there's a kind of religious cult around that martyrdom, which has very little to do with his politics and everything to do with the way that he died sacrificially. In Argentina, which he had almost nothing to do with for most of his life after the Motorcycle Diaries, he's a national celebrity like Evita Perón or Carlos Gardel, the tango singer. I mean, he's famous because he's famous.
And these are kind of the high manifestations. There have been plenty of low manifestations, or at least simple popular culture, even The Simpsons, and right on through. Cite a few examples for us.
Well, there are probably nearly as many T-shirts with Che Guevara's image on them as there are with the image of Mickey Mouse at this point. And I think that his resemblance to the guy on the package of bamboo rolling papers, you know, might have helped, that he seemed to be a kind of electrifying hippie in a way. I mean, just, you know, an essence of coolness and of youthful rebellion. And that's why he would be associated with T-shirts, with beer. There are a number of bars all over the world that are named after him, not just the Che Guevara, which, as they called it on The Simpsons, which is very, very witty. You know, that he's, you know, being on a, on skis or cigars. These are things that he's associated in a way with leisure, upscale activities, too.
But now, all over the place, and most notably in film, with the Motorcycle Diaries out, people talking about another Che film coming with Benicio del Toro, another with Antonio Banderas. I mean, what's going on the Hollywood front? Why?
You know, they've been talking about those movies for a while, but I think that they'll happen now, especially since the Motorcycle Diary seems like it's going to be a success. And one thing is that I imagine you can cast Che as a kind of purely heroic figure, not beyond political controversy, perhaps, but his youth, his martyrdom, his idealism, his good looks, all of those things would make him an irresistible figure for an actor to play. And my assumption is that these other projects are actor-driven. We already know who wants to play the part.
Right. And what about the politics? Do they filter through at all?
You know, it's certainly significant that in the 60s, Che would have been this universal emblem of the new left, the third world youth culture revolt. And now, in the early 21st century, he's no less universal, but he's kind of a universal corporate logo. It's a different kind of international that he represents. And, you know, it's a kind of hell, I would think, for Che, were he to, you know, understand what happened to him. That he's just a trademark that can be used, but he's a trademark that everybody understands.
For the man who wanted to remake the world.
Yes, yeah. But a great trademark, nonetheless.
I guess. Jim Hoberman, thanks very much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Jim Hoberman is film critic for The Village Voice.
This isn't a tale of heroic feats. It's about two lives running parallel for a while. The plan, 5,000 miles in 4 months. The goal, to explore a continent they had only known in books. The method, improvisation. The further they went, the more they could feel the world changing. Or maybe it was them.
That was the trailer from the new film, The Motorcycle Diaries, about Che Guevara's stirring from medical student to revolutionary. We're talking tonight about the return of Che Guevara in popular culture. Did you throw out your Che Guevara poster 30 years ago? Did you buy a new one this year? Is Che back? And what does he mean this time around? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Jay Cantor, author of The Death of Che Guevara and a professor of English at Tufts University. Jay Cantor, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Also with us tonight from New York is Carlos Riobo, professor of Spanish and Latin American cultures at Barnard College of Columbia University. Carlos Riobo, thank you for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Jay Cantor and Carlos Riobo both, I want to first just get your impressions of what it is, in your view, that's brought Che back to what seems to many of us like all of a sudden. It may not look that way to you, Jay. You followed him much of your life at this point. Why do you think he's so back in the news right now?
Some of it, I think, might be the accident of movie release schedules. Some of it, I think, probably is something that you were mentioning before, which is, for whatever reason, some of even the leadership in the United States openly uses the word imperialism. And Che, when he's not being a logo on products, was a singular, focused representative of the struggle against imperialism.
Carlos Riobo, how about it? As simple and complex as that, we live in a time when it's true, as Jay Cantor says, the word imperialism is used enthusiastically by no small number of global strategic thinkers. Is Che's return part and parcel of that?
I certainly would agree with Mr. Cantor, but I would also say that Che has always been a darling of the new left, and I'm not sure he's ever fully left the consciousness of the left in the United States. My sense is that he is the perfect face to put on the revolution and to put on a revolution that was being fought on different fronts. He is a figure who advocated for that type of freedom and anti-imperialism throughout the world. He can be claimed by many nations, by Cuba, Argentina, by Mexico, by Africa, and it goes on and on. So my sense is that Che Guevara is or has become this ubiquitous figure. It almost seems like he's been everywhere, and he was everywhere at the same time. So now, in the age of mass media, when it's so easy to reproduce someone's image and to give it new life, Che Guevara is living on even more.
Easy to reproduce, but then it was easy when Warhol did it, and I think it was our Jim Hoberman who said, Jay Cantor, that Warhol was almost redundant, even when he did his, Che, because he'd already been reproduced all over the place. Carlos Rebo says he's in the popular consciousness. That's clearly the case, that you know the images don't go away, and yet there have been ups and downs. I mean, there was a time after the 1970s when this guy was not having movies made about him anymore.
I think it's fair to say that within what Carlos was referring to as the new left, sure, but the new left itself was greatly reduced in numbers during the 80s and throughout the 90s. I think part of what's changed is a consciousness of the nature of, for good and bad, United States power, imperial power. So, again, I think there's a resurgence of interest not just in the icon, but in what the icon himself thought he stood for.
Carlos, have you seen the new movie, The Motorcycle Diaries?
No, I haven't yet.
You've got to catch it. It's a very kind of dreamy, beautiful scenes across South America, and a very beautiful actor playing Che Guevara. Of course, this is from Robert Redford, I guess, is executive producer here. And Jay, you must have seen it by now.
Yes,
it's some evocative, who can't love this guy kind of film by and large. Not the man who said, of course, as you quote him, hatred as an element of the struggle, relentless hatred that impels us over and over beyond the natural limitations of man and transforms us into effective, violent, selective, and cold killing machines. I mean, that sounds, that resonates quite differently today, almost the sound of a terrorist.
An advocate of total war, to take the war into the homes of the imperial power. He was a violent man who advocated violence. That's from a speech hoping to create one, two, three, many Vietnams throughout the world. Part of the problem with The Motorcycle Diaries is, as you say, it's a beautiful movie, and I think there's a meaning to the beauty. I think the director means to contrast the sublime beauty of Latin America against the tragedy of the Indian lives that he shows also.
The peasantry and the poverty.
Yeah. But that it can coexist at the same time with such natural beauty, and it's implied with the possibility of a very different kind of life. Having said that, the movie seems to me deficient in that way. It's hard. I could not from the movie. There is one line in the movie where Alberto says to...
This is his traveling companion.
Yeah, his traveling companion, Alberto Granados, who wrote a wonderful memoir of Che, which is also a basis for the movie, called My Friend Che. And Guevara says there will have to be we need to have a revolution, and Alberto agrees. And this Guevara in this movie says there'll have to be guns. So there's that.
Guns right away, even in that beauty of youth. Jay Cantor, Carlos Riobo, standby. We're talking tonight about Che Guevara and his surprising reappearance at the peaks of popular culture in 2004. Is Che just glamour and image now, an empty beret, or something more? Who is Che to you, a hero, a killer, a dreamer? We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the unexpected reappearance of Che Guevara at the peaks of pop culture in the United States and around the world in the year 2004, many years after his popularity in the 1960s, many years after his death, sorting out what to make of it. We want to ask you the question, why is Che Guevara back? And is Che's resurgence a cultural response to America's new unilateralism, some would say, some proudly would say, imperialism? Who is Che to you? A hero, a killer, a dreamer, an old friend, an old enemy, something new on your horizon? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by Jay Cantor, author of the terrific novel, The Death of Che Guevara, also professor of English at Tufts University, and from Barnard College at Columbia in New York. Carlos Riobo teaches Cuban literature. You can join us as well, 1-800-423-8255. Jay Cantor, we'll have people who know the Che Guevara story like the back of their hand, and others who will be wondering who is this guy who's suddenly showing up all over the place again. Give us the condensed life history of Che.
Che came from basically an upper-middle-class family in Argentina, from a family of some privilege. He trained to be a doctor. I think that was a very real commitment on his part to help people as a doctor. What you see in the Motorcycle Diaries, what you could read in the Motorcycle Diaries, is he leaves Argentina just before graduating to travel through Latin America.
And you say read, this is actually the journal he
the
kept.
Journal,
of
yeah,
this,
called the Motorcycle.
The movie is based roughly on the journal that he
right,
kept.
Right, or even, I think even better, you could read Granados' own book, My Friend Che, mm-hmm. or you could read my novel. In that,
a terrific
even
novel,
better,
I have to say.
Thank you very much. Reissued by Vintage in January.
Bravo.
And he's traveling throughout Latin America. It's his first exposure, really, to the life of the peasantry, to the how easily they were thrown off their land, expropriated by the rich, how many of them had to work, for example, for Anaconda mining. We see that in the movies in hellish conditions within what could be the beauty of Latin America, which represents the possibility of prosperity for Latin America. He began to feel, he was already feeling throughout this trip, that we shouldn't talk about a country as underdeveloped, but as a country as having been underdeveloped, forced to be underdeveloped.
That, it's an active, not a passive
that,
status.
Yes. And essentially he's pointing to the United States and to the industrialized West as having underdeveloped countries, having made sure that they would be underdeveloped by making sure that what they did and all that they did was sell natural resources to be manufactured by the industrialized West and then sold back to them.
How did he go from the motorcycle back dreamer to rebel, revolutionary?
Well, he already has some political consciousness. He's seeing what's happening in Latin America. And during this trip, he continues on and he goes to Guatemala, where an essentially socialist government had been elected and beyond doubt democratically elected. And one of the first acts was they expropriated the land of the United Fruit Company. Mm-hmm. The brother of the head of United Fruit at that time was the head of the CIA.
So this is a big stick under the nose of the United States.
Right. And whether intentionally or not, mm-hmm. it provoked the Central Intelligence Army to train an army to overthrow that government, which they did. And Guevara was there when it happened. He watched a democratically elected but socialist government being overthrown. He, at that point, became an activist, I think. He began to try to organize some resistance. There was a little resistance, but not much. And he was essentially, one might say, run out of town. There mm-hmm. was a price on his head, and he had to flee. He fled to Mexico, where he now increasingly committed to the struggle against what he would describe already as imperialism, met Fidel Castro, who had a breathtakingly stupid idea, which was that they would rent a boat with about 80 people. They would go to Cuba, where Castro was already a well-known radical, and they would land in Cuba, and this would be so attractive to the people of Cuba that people would either the peasantry would flock to them, city people would flock to them, and they would be able to defeat Batista's army.
They would be the spark, the wildfire would come, that would be that.
Yes. Tom is quoting Lenin there, by the way. And truly. And they landed, and they were poorly trained, but trained or not, within about an hour, I think all but eight of them died, were killed by Batista's army.
Eight, including the lucky ones, Fidel and Che.
Well, survived, indeed, mm-hmm. by luck. In fact, the two of the leaders, and Raul Castro, Fidel's brother, survived by luck, made it to the mountains. And slowly, people did come to them. They made forays against the army. The forays got some publicity. It began to be called armed propaganda. And people came to them. And it was a long struggle of, I think, about 6 years, and culminating in the defeat of Batista's army, the marching into Havana, and the beginning of Castro's regime in Cuba. That regime was slowly radicalized. I think Guevara's ambition had always became by that point to build a communist society. He could not imagine that a society that was not communal, where land was shared, etc., that anything else would be able to develop Latin America, or in this case, starting with Cuba.
So that socialist history of Cuba has so much to do with Che, not just in the rebellion itself, but in the way, in the architecture of the society that followed, that sent many Cubans fleeing Cuba.
Right, because Guevara was four square against the market. As far as he was concerned, it wasn't market forces that should determine people's lives. It would be the social needs of people as he saw them.
Carlos Riobo, your parents were Cuban. You've paid a lot of attention to this. How would you describe, maybe let's start personally, your own parents' view of Che Guevara? Were they admirers, or very often if you didn't admire him, you hated him?
Well, as you might suspect, since I live in New York, they were not admirers mm-hmm. of Che Guevara. Mm-hmm. In fact, they continue not to be admirers of Che Guevara. However, I do have family in Cuba still, and I have been in Cuba and in Havana and in Santiago, the eastern province, recently for research. And when I've gone to families' homes, I have seen photos of Che Guevara on their walls. So I thought that was a very sort of interesting development. Prior to our leaving Cuba, they were not admirers of Che Guevara, but now they seem to be. So he has he's creeped into their consciousnesses as well for more obvious reasons.
And when you say they, you mean ordinary Cubans who you visited or relatives who your family is still living there?
Well, I would say both relatives as well as Cubans who are pretty high up in certain government positions. I have done research in the libraries, in the National Library, and in other institutions, cultural institutions, and I've gone to people's homes, and they have had basically shrines to Che. Now, there are no pictures of Fidel, and there aren't really very many images of Fidel on the streets in comparison to images of Che Guevara. So I think that the fact that Che was cut down relatively young gives him that kind of allure and that kind of myth that Fidel doesn't have, because Fidel is present all the time.
And growing into his great age, not that taking off in the relative or the beauty of relative youth. I want to continue this story of Che, but I want to bring our callers in as well. John's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, John. You're on the air.
That's me?
Yes, that's you, John.
Oh, good. At the beginning of the show, you mentioned how the concept of imperialism is, in the air today.
Certainly is, yeah.
I assume you mean a lot of the books and stuff that even your own shows have showed, with American imperialism. I assume that's pretty much what Che was opposed to.
Well, there's a whole school of thought, as you know now, and some of it in quite powerful positions, that the U.S. should be more active in something like an imperial way in the violent, difficult world that we see now. It's taken on a new kind of credibility in certain circles.
Right. So in response to that whole philosophy that, like, you're kind of sort of articulating the, I guess what you might say, the pro-U.S. position, just in that little statement you made. I'm not saying you personally are saying it.
I'm just saying it's out there. The word is back. Some people hate it. Some people embrace it these days.
Right. So in response to that, I'm saying that the whole progressive movement, in kind of as the children of Che and the children of Castro, is, in a sense, a lot of them would still say, and I used to believe this myself, I grew up in that kind of home, like your guests there have said, you know, that you have splits within the family. Well, in my family, I was raised in a very kind of sympathetic to Che. My dad was a doctor, and he said, you know, he would sit around and he'd say, oh, Che was a good guy, you know,
yeah.
Or just in a general sense, a romantic, maybe a failure, but he, coming from being a doctor, he could identify with that, and my mom still says that.
And how do you see it now, John?
So what I'm saying now is, Arab imperialism is this problem that is in Darfur, it's in Kurdistan, it's Mauritanian slaves, it was in Zanzibar. 1964, Zanzibar Muslims, just like Darfur Muslims, Kurdish Muslims, all fighting Arab imperialism, but yet no one sees this invisible empire. And it's never been touched by Castro, and Jesse Jackson had a Palestine Arab plank in 1984. So whoever embraced Darfur and it except George Bush.
So you're saying imperialism is more complicated than just the United States these days?
Yes, it's just horrible. The Arab imperialists have, and it's not against just Coptic Christians. It's not just against Aramaic Christians or Jews. It's against Muslim Kurds, Muslim Darfur, Muslim Mauritanian black slaves. Zanzibar, and then Nasser blamed Israel for Zanzibar revolution. Nasser,
John,
blamed...
we've got it. You're giving us some nuance on this right away, Che Cantor. Of course, Che put it all on the United States, but Cuba had its problems with the Soviet Union. It wasn't always sweetness and light there, so they were capable of split screen. But do you think he would have seen what John's describing here?
Well, let me. I think there are two elements here. Guevara had tremendous problems with the Soviet Union, which he thought was bureaucratic and attempting to found an empire.
In its own way, imperial, yeah.
I'm not – whether or not one would there is no doubt that, for example, in the Sudan now, the Muslim elements would like to take control of what natural resources there are now and are likely to be in the future, which includes oil. Whether to use the word empire or imperialism for that, I couldn't say, but it is an awful thing. I'm not quite sure how it fits in our map.
Well,
if one wanted to say that is an awful thing, yes. I think there was it John?
Yes.
I think there's room for more than one awful thing in the world.
I might echo that by also saying that Che Guevara actually wrote message to the Tricontinental, I believe it was in the late 60s, 1967 or so, in which he openly criticizes the Soviet Union. And at this point, he really is accusing it of being, in a sense, imperialistic toward what he suggested were southern hemispheric nations, the same thing the U.S. was doing. So it wasn't just anti-U.S. I suppose it did start that way.
So hard to say how that would translate looking out on the world. Right now, Chris is calling from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, good to have you.
I think one of the things that hasn't really been brought up, and it's something that they talk that Che writes about in some of his letters, is the whole Marxist side of this, as opposed to necessarily just the imperialist side. And I think that, at least the way that I see it, is that portion of what Che was about was this sort of counterculture to you know, the Marxist side against capitalism. And I think maybe part of the revival is the fact that people now are seeing, you know, big corporations getting benefits and pieces like this, and it's the return of Chase is really just sort of the counter to that. You know, there's theories out there that the reason that no one finds a cure for AIDS is because pharmaceuticals can make more money on long-term drug cocktails to treat the symptoms, and
you've got Che as all perpetually there, waiting to be pulled out if you want to be angry with the powers that be.
Exactly. He's sort of a countercultural figure, and as someone who you know, granted, I own a Che T-shirt, and you know, there is a piece of that's sort of, you know, the rebellion of what Che's all about.
Yeah.
And I just sort of, the way I see it is that he does sort of stand for that larger picture of that counterculture, fighting for the ordinary guy. And in fact, one of the things that I've always struggled with is is how do I be, you know, thoughtful and leftist and sympathetic, and the struggle with the bloody side of Che and his legacy.
Jay Cantor.
I think that puts it just right. There is the statement that Tom quoted from the message of the Tricontinental, that one needed to become a cold, violent, selective killing machine is, I think, as you're implying, is a very chilling statement. At the same time, what Guevara saw is also true, and that is the underdeveloped world where I think still to this day about 40,000 children a week die from diseases related to hunger. I may be overstating the statistic. I took it from a piece of Ariel Dorfman's. I haven't checked it. But what he saw might be right. And so then the question of his life is, what other path? I don't have an answer to that question.
If not the violent, cold,
right,
selective
killing machine, then what other path that isn't simply to ignore what he saw? I don't have an answer to that, by the way.
You know, of course, but you quote him saying, let me say, with the risk of appearing ridiculous, that the true revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. Now, the enemies of Che are not going to applaud that as his prime moving sentiment, but there it is, and it stands right next to the hatred and the violence.
And I think what makes him so interesting is that both were true for him, that he felt, I believe, both those things. I don't think he took easily to violence.
Amy's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi. I actually called for one question. I ended up thinking of another one.
Okay.
The first one was, starts off with a comment, ends up with a question. My family, I have a great uncle who was in jail for 20 years in Cuba.
Oh.
For standing up against Castro, and we always heard stories that were very anti-Che. And I'm just wondering if the person that's there knows why it is that in the myth of Che, the negative aspects or the mercenary aspects that he ended up making a lot of the money that he used for the revolution in Cuba by killing Cubans doesn't get brought up anywhere as often in the myth, especially in the United States. And also, if the resurgence of Che is part of an idealization that people have with Hispanic society.
I mean, idealizing things that your family or your uncle certainly wouldn't idealize. Amy, thanks for your call. Carlos Urobo, we've just got a few seconds before the break, but I think we're hearing both sides of this tonight, but Amy reminds us of the polarization around this man and very different histories depending where your family stood in Cuba.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are numerous positive lessons to be drawn from his life and from his path. I think we should remember that he first started out admiring Gandhi very much, but then decided that that truly was not the path to revolution. You needed violence. The other thing to be remembered is that many people would say that he really played a key role in what I suppose Samuel Farber, who's a socialist scholar, has called the gulag system in Cuba for social deviance, and most notoriously for homosexual people.
And maybe Amy's uncle was somewhere in there. Carlos Urobo, Jay Cantor, stand by. We're talking about the resurgence of Che Guevara. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Che Guevara and his surprising reappearance at the peaks of pop culture in the year 2004. Why do you think Che Guevara is back, and what would Che be doing today? Investment banking? Rebellion? Something else? Are you captured or repelled by the Che aura? What's the Che resonance now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with Jay Cantor, novelist, author of The Death of Che Guevara, and from New York, Carlos Urobo, professor of Spanish and Latin American cultures at Barnard College at Columbia, teaches Cuban literature. Ricardo's calling from Boston. Hi, Ricardo. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks
good,
for
good.
Taking the call.
Sure. What's on your mind, Carlos? Ricardo.
Oh, what is in my mind?
Yes.
No, I just wanted to say that the movie Motorcycle Diaries was a great movie. It was actually very close to the Che's diaries. And I also wanted to say that the image of the Che Guevara has been also misportrayed, especially, I mean, probably globally, is being kind of like capitalized to some extent to the romanticization.
Capitalized, certainly turned into a million products. I'm looking at a website homepage here, Ricardo, where you can buy about any article of clothing you can imagine with Che on it.
Yeah, which is actually kind of like contradictory to his ideals.
So you're an admirer, even now. You think his message is still relevant?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, no as they were before, but some people still feel, it's some sort of like sympathy to his ideals.
Sympathy, to say the least, among the people who look past just the commercialization, and if they don't hate him, they may well love him. Ricardo, thanks very much for your call. You know, Jay Cantor, I wish you'd take us from that moment you described. You got us to in the Che history, where his motorcycle trip is well behind him. He's arm in arm with Fidel. They've taken Cuba. We know that by 1967, he's dead in Bolivia. Take us between those two points.
He becomes the chief architect of the Cuban economy. That is not necessarily a good cut line on his resume. For example, he wouldn't allow any free market even for small farmers. He thought all should be socially controlled, which meant, in this case, controlled by the Communist Party and the government. The Cuban economy was not going well. It was a time when, however, nonetheless, Vietnam was an active revolution. It looked like there was the possibility, he thought, not only to save the Cuban economy, but to save the underdeveloped world by uniting it in revolution against imperialism. And he left Cuba, actually first for the Congo, to try to start a revolutionary movement there. Again, actually, in a way, repeating what Fidel had done. It would be a small group of men fighting the army in the Congo, kind of armed propaganda, drawing other people to them. But this time it didn't work. They were almost completely wiped out. Mm-hmm. Che and the few Cubans that came with him, escaped, returned to Cuba. And from there, though, left again with the same aim and the same method to start a revolution in Bolivia. Bolivia, you can read his own diaries and the diaries of his men in Bolivia, was a hard, endless slog through the countryside. We haven't touched on this. Che was terribly asthmatic.
Mm-hmm. From youth, from childhood.
From infancy. Mm-hmm. So that and what you'll read in the diaries is a man who is struggling just to get the drugs he needs part of the time, the epinephrine, so that he can breathe because they keep running out. Mm-hmm. Fidel, at the insistence of the Soviet Union, I think abandoned Guevara in Bolivia. There's no way to prove that one way or the other. There is no doubt that the Soviet Union did not want 1, 2, 3 many Vietnams. In any case, neither did the peasantry in Bolivia. They made not one recruit. The U.S. had learned a great deal from what happened in Vietnam. They had trained the Bolivian army well. They provided the leadership for the anti-guerrilla movement. Guevara was captured. All but four of his men were killed. He was taken to captured in a small mountain town, La Higuera, where the CIA, as you said, ordered his execution. The last thing he said was, "You are killing a man." It was his way. I don't know all that meant. Perhaps
the obvious suggestion, you can't kill the idea.
Could be that you can't kill the idea. It could also have meant, get on with it, I'm just a man. I don't know all that he meant. But they didn't kill something that he represented, which is the heritage that we're debating now.
And Carlos
Urobo, I think that finishes the story, that part of the story.
That part of it. Carlos Urobo, as you say, in Cuba today, this is a story that everyone knows. Is it still part of state propaganda education there?
It is, very much so. If you go to the Revolution Square or La Plaza de la Revolución, you see a gigantic image of Che Guevara as a mosaic on the facade of one of the buildings. In certain classrooms that I visited on my first trip to Cuba when I was doing a different type of research, certainly Che Guevara was part of one of the lessons that I witnessed there. So I believe that he is a figure that whose memory continues to be stoked. He's also part of the popular culture. He has been written into music. There have been songs written to him and about him. And in fact, this last time I was in Cuba in March of this year, every night at dinner in my hotel, they would come around and start playing the Che Guevara song. And it was mostly, you know, I'll say it, mostly most of the people there were Americans and some Canadians, and everyone was clamoring for that particular song. So I think that that the Cuban people know that his image has been exported and is very popular abroad, and also I think there's a homegrown industry to perpetuate his image on the island.
Yeah, they don't call him popular for nothing. Gabe's calling from Boston. Hi, Gabe. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Hi, Professor Cantor. I'm calling because just to speak about why I find myself recently kind of compelled and interested in Che in this time where there seems to be, in our country, leaders who are very fond of speaking in lofty ideals, which in certain moments don't sound so far off from Che's, you know, spreading democracy over the globe, et cetera. Mm. And yet there is kind of an extreme, I would say, disconnect between their rhetoric and their actions. And while this is going on, I find myself kind of interested in Che's actions and life at the same time, while, you know, of course, I'm uncomfortable with the violent elements and the things which your guests have been speaking of, but there does seem to be a certain conviction behind his words and the way that he carried them out, which might be refreshing in these times.
Yeah, Gabe, we hear it. We hear it. And thank you for chipping that in. Jay Cantor, I can't help contrasting, though. You're describing just now, and you write in the front of the death of Che Guevara, the world was a very different place. There was this sense of a wave of revolutions that might mount up to a changed planet. Now we're in a time of battening down the hatches or trying to. It doesn't. I mean, there's an Islamist push against the United States or the West, however you want to describe it, but it's hardly the same feeling.
No, I think the Islamist push against the United States would be in every way antithetical to anything that Guevara thought. That's a theocratic, anti-civilizational, anti-industrialization. He wasn't anti-industrialization. He wanted all the people of the world to benefit from it. There's nothing about the Islamic jihadist that is at all congruent with the communist revolutionary. What's probably relevant about Guevara, well, I don't know. I can't speak. Well, one element that's relevant has to do with what Gabe was saying. Lenin, who you quoted earlier, said, if you want to know what the bourgeoisie are thinking, don't listen to their words, watch their hands. And what one could say is they're talking about democracy, and I think actually mean it up to a point. But at some point, when democracy comes in conflict with securing the natural resource, in this case oil, democracy will undoubtedly be sacrificed to secure that resource. Guevara can at least make us aware that that is likely to happen and to work within our own country to see that it doesn't.
Carlos Rubio, we've just got half a minute here. How do you ultimately see this, I wouldn't say man now, but icon now, a symbol of political change today, a symbol of stylishness, a symbol of the past, of a time gone?
I think everything you said is correct, Tom. I think that he was a middle-class Argentine, upper-middle-class, had a certain degree of privilege. He was a professional. He was a doctor. I think that resonates with a lot of upper middle class or middle class people in the United States who have, you know, a certain degree of privilege as far as education is concerned or as far as professionalism is concerned. And my sense is that he's the perfect icon for them. He's a global figure.
Kind of I or they could be that rebel too. Carlos Gilbert, we're out of time. We're so grateful to you for being with us tonight. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jay Cantor, author of The Death of Che Guevara, wonderful novel, even today, I must say. Thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The U.S. Postal Service this week issued a new set of commemorative cloud stamps. The pane of 15 cloudscape stamps features photographs of 9 different cloud formations. In the bottom right-hand corner, there is a stamp featuring a photo of a cumulonimbus cloud with a tornado. It's the only picture in the set that was shot by an amateur photographer. Edie Ann Otto of Osnabrück, North Dakota, took the photo when a tornado funnel passed near her family's farm. It was one photo of 20 she took that day. Many have been published around the world. In this radio diary, Edie Ann Otto recalls the day the tornado came and how it came to be the subject of a U.S. postage stamp.
The day I took the pictures was July 25th, 1978. The picture is actually 26 years old now. And that day, I was in the house most of the day, so I didn't really know what the weather was doing, but it was a very warm day, and there was basically only that one cloud in the sky, because I did take out lunch of a fellow that we had working for us, and that was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I had made a remark that I don't even think we'll get any rain out of that cloud. I entered a contest with the Farm Wife News, and I won third place there. And the Severe Storm Center in Norman, Oklahoma, saw that magazine, and they wrote and asked if they could get a picture like that. So I sent in the series of 20 tornado pictures that I had. And then they called me, and they ordered all kinds of pictures. And that's really where it all started, because when Time Life put out a book called Storm, and they were told by Norman, Oklahoma, to get a hold of me. And then from there, that just went worldwide. So then it just started to get used and used. I was asked maybe 6 to 8 years ago by an agency, a woman had called me and asked me if she could present my picture, that picture, for a stamp. And I said, sure, go ahead. I really didn't think after that time that it would become a stamp. But I would get a little note from her every once in a while saying it's still in there. They have not rejected it. So I was thrilled when they did finally pick it. A lot of local post offices have asked me to come in and sit down and have a little cake and coffee and explain the tornado picture and that. I think it's great that it'll be on, be flying all over the country on envelopes.
Edie Ann Otto lives on a farm 25 miles from the Canadian border near Osnabrück, North Dakota. You can see her stamp at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.